So he's going to tell us about quantum thermodynamics in the Gaussian regime.
Thanks. Yeah, so of course, as always, I would like to thank Lucian and Rob Speckens for the invitation here and for Perimeter for being such awesome hosts. I had so far a very, very good week. Fortunately, it's been so energetic that I'm finding myself crashing now, including my voice and my throat. So hopefully this will go okay. I will be talking today about two pieces of work, one which is finished and one which is still very much ongoing. It's not going to be so much a results-based talk, since I don't have that many results, but I hope to be able to give at least a nice story and share with you why I find stuff interesting. As the title suggests, I should mention that I work at ICFO in Barcelona. My supervisor is Antonio Sin in the Quantum Information Group. And yeah, these works, I'll tell who I did them with. But I will be looking at quantum thermodynamics, which is sort of a large, it's becoming a popular subject now. And I will specifically be looking at it within a Gaussian quantum mechanics perspective, as that is sort of my background and my expertise. And I feel that I felt that I could bring to bear the tools of this within quantum thermodynamics. So that's kind of what I would like to talk about today. Just a brief note on my background. I did my PhD here with Robert Mann at University of Waterloo. And then I was sort of doing a field theory using Gaussian quantum mechanics. So looking at, you know, if we have some field mode, is there a laser pointer or something? Okay, cool. Yeah, so I mean, basically what I was doing during my PhD is I was looking at field theory, either in free space or in a cavity, and describing the information content of it, or looking at the dynamics via a Gaussian quantum mechanics perspective. Within Gaussian quantum mechanics, what we do is we assume you have a Gaussian state, which just means that on a phase-based picture, the Wigner function or whatever other characteristic function you choose to use is a Gaussian. That's just one way of defining it, characterized by its covariance matrix as opposed to its density operator. And as I hope to show, you can do certain things in this framework that are very hard to do otherwise. In particular, rather than looking at field theory, I would like to look at quantum thermodynamics and what a Gaussian regime actually gives us within this context. So this is basically the main thing, the main drive of this talk. I have two primary questions, and I'll be looking at two projects for each of them, or one project for each of them. The first, which I'll be looking at first, is kind of how Gaussian quantum mechanics is a restriction of normal quantum mechanics. And so when you work within that restriction, which happens to be somewhat easier to do in certain contexts, what does that imply thermodynamically? What do we lose when we go to this restriction? The other one I'll be talking about is kind of how the computational power of Gaussian quantum mechanics can help us analyze interesting quantum thermodynamics, which you would be hard to do otherwise. First, I'll be talking about this one. But before I go into those, I figured I should probably just give a very, very brief, in a nutshell, overview of the kinds of things that people do when working in quantum thermodynamics. So this is a very brief list that I just came up with. People look at things like equilibration, i.e. thermalization of quantum systems, the storage and extraction of work. If you have like a quantum battery, how can you put in energy, store that, and then hopefully later get that energy back out? This has to do also with quantum thermal machines, which will be the topic of my second part of the talk. The structure and the geometry of thermal operations, what can you do with thermal states and unitaries? What kind of states can you go to which using those kinds of operations? This is very much related to resource theories, which of course is much broader than thermal, but Rob Speckens kind of, I think, was the first one to get the idea to try to use resource theories within a quantum thermodynamics type of scenario. You have fluctuation theorems, which are very old, and all these things kind of seem to suggest at an informational point of view as well. For example, at the Landauer principle, which tells you that, you know, if you want to erase a bit of work, you have to expend a certain amount of energy at a certain temperature. And so most of these things have something to do with information, and that's also a large part of the motivation for why we do these. This talk will not be about entanglement. Oh yeah, sorry. I should also mention, if you want a general good overview of quantum thermodynamics, check out this paper by Gould et cetera, which was just published last year. This talk will not be about entanglement, but just to quickly mention that entanglement seems to play a very strong role in most of these aspects of quantum thermodynamics. And so how that will develop is very interesting. And a very quick, a nutshell intro to what Gaussian quantum mechanics is. As I said, Gaussian quantum mechanics is just normal quantum mechanics. Here we are looking at a collection of continuous variable harmonic oscillator modes. So just an ensemble of quantum systems, which are harmonic oscillators, which have a pair of canonical quadratures, Qs and Ps. And the Gaussian part comes when we restrict all the relevant Hamiltonians that we care about to be quadratic, okay, or less, and thermal states thereof of such Hamiltonians. Basically, that's basically what it reduces to. Up to some small caveats, but that's how you should think of it. Gaussian states are thermal states of quadratic Hamiltonians, but this happens to include quite a lot of states that we are interested in, such as ground and thermal states, squeeze states, coherent states. A lot of the states that you hear, but within a quantum optics setup, are Gaussian states. And you can go to the resulting open systems formulation as well, which is quite simple and neat. Just to continue a bit, what we do is, instead of working in the Hilbert space of our system, when we do Gaussian quantum mechanics, we look just at the phase space, at the Qs and Ps of our harmonic oscillators. We replace, or rather than use a density matrix to describe our state, assuming we are working with a Gaussian state, we can instead fully describe it with what's called the covariance matrix, which is just a matrix of basically the second moments of your system in phase space. I will give a proper definition of that later. And when you're working on this phase space picture, rather than doing unitaries, we work with symplectic operations. So your covariance matrix evolves or is transformed via this kind of relation, similar to how you would evolve the density matrix with the unitary. And if your unitary is generated by a quadratic Hamiltonian, it will have a representation as a symplectic matrix on the phase space. So why are we doing this again? Actually, my voice is going pretty well. I'm happy. So it seems pretty restrictive to just limit ourselves to quadratic Hamiltonians and interactions in systems. So why do it? Kind of two motivations. In practice, in laboratory setups, particularly within optical setups, tends to be pretty a lot easier to do linear transformations, i.e. Gaussian, than non-Gaussian operations. So from an experimental point of view, it is pertinent to understand what the limitations are of this. And second of all, this is more my perspective, the math is easy, which means that you can do things calculation-wise that would be very hard to do otherwise. The basic reason why the math is easy is that if you have two systems, the Hilbert space is composed via a tensor product, the phase space is composed via a direct sum, which means your dimensionality is in general much, much nicer and easier to work with the matrices. So back to our two main questions. Let's look at the first one first. How thermodynamically restrictive is a Gaussian regime? Now, this is a very large question. I'm going to look at one specific question that falls within this category. And that is having to do with, how am I doing in time? I'm going quite fast, aren't I? Okay. This is to do with this. What I want to talk about within this question is looking at what's called passivity in the quantum thermodynamics community. We have a specific definition for passivity in this case, which I'll explain. This is work with Nikolai Fries and Marcus Huber. Nikolai is, I believe, still at Innsbruck, although he may have moved. Marcus is in Vienna. And the publication for this is here, archive, if you want to look at it. So what is passivity? This, forgetting Gaussian for a second, let's just look at what I mean by passivity. A quantum state, in general, is passive if you cannot get energy out of it via some unitary. Okay, if you have some rho and you cannot find any unitary from which you can lower the energy of rho, that is, get energy out of it, then that state is passive. Okay, and from this perspective kind of useless because you can't get energy out of it. That's kind of the idea. That is, just in math language, if there exists a U such that you can lower the energy, you transform your state, given whatever Hamiltonian you have, if you can lower the energy, the average energy of your state via some unitary, then rho is by definition not passive. Okay. By the way, this first part of my talk, it's cool, but I find it less interesting than the second talk. So if you get bored, don't worry. The second part will hopefully wake you up. Right. Now, the form of a passive state has actually been known for quite a while. It was first proved in 78 that a state rho is passive if and only if it is diagonal in the energy eigenbasis and such that the populations decrease for increasing energy eigenvalues. Okay, this kind of makes sense if you just think of unitaries as being swapping between energy eigenstates, this makes perfect sense. If you have, an energy of one, an energy of two, and you have a higher population in the lower energy state, then if you try to swap those two, you're going to put that higher population in the higher energy state, which means that you're increasing the energy of your system, not decreasing it. And you want to decrease it. You want to get energy out of it. So if your populations are ordered in this way, it turns out that more generally, there's no unitary which can lower the energy on average. So this is a passive state. We don't like those, at least from an operational perspective. A very important example of a passive state is a thermal state. So a thermal state is just expectation value of some number times a negative number times the Hamiltonian. This is just a Boltzmann distribution. If we consider the specific case of a harmonic oscillator, a frequency omega, this takes this form where these are just, again, the Boltzmann factors. And as you know, as you increase the energy, or as you go to the higher energy eigenspaces, your population, your thermal population, of course, that decreases. And this is just given by the Boltzmann factor in line with this definition or result for passivity. This is a bit of an aside. It's not really important for the rest of the talk, but I wanted to mention it. Just the fact that thermal states are in fact the unique set of what we call completely passive states. A completely passive state is one for which it doesn't matter how many copies of that state you have, you still can't do anything with the whole. Any other non-thermal passive state, i.e. ones that have the probabilities decreasing, but are not, don't follow a Boltzmann distribution. If you have some number n copies of that state, you can do some giant unitary to get work out at some number n. Okay, thermal states are the unique set which you cannot do that for. Doesn't matter how many you have of the same temperature, assuming they are the same thermal states. Doesn't matter how many you have, you can never get any work out of it. That does not mean that you can't get work out of two thermal states. Oh crap! This should be a beta 2. If you have two thermal states of different temperatures, this is wrong. Then you can get work out of that, which is very good, since that's how heat engines work and the weather works and pretty much everything in the universe works. If this wasn't true, nothing would happen. So that's good for us. So going back to our little theorem here, this is our result for what in a sense, a useless state is, up to the fact that if you have a whole bunch of them, if it's not thermal, at some point you can hopefully get some work out. But this theorem for passivity, which is very old, it assumes that you can use any unitary that you want on your system to hopefully get work out, which is great, but that's not always the easiest to do in practice. So the main point of this part of the talk is, how does this theorem change when we restrict our operations to a certain class? In particular, here I'll be talking about what happens when you restrict your operations to just Gaussian unitaries, that is, unitaries generated by quadratic Hamiltonians, as opposed to whatever unitary you want. Okay, it will obviously be more restrictive, right? Any what I'm going to call Gaussian passive state, any passive state will also be Gaussian passive, not the other way around. If you have a state which you cannot get any energy out of via a Gaussian unitary, that does not mean that you can't get any energy out via some other unitary. It just means that you can't do it with Gaussian. So it'll be a subset of passive states, and we just want to know how small is that subset for practical purposes, right? Because again, in an optical setup laboratory, it's much easier to do Gaussian operations in general. So if you want to have some sort of work storage device in that kind of setup, it's important to know what you can and can't do with your set of operations that you can most easily perform. So yes, this is what I just said, which quantum, so again, we're considering some ensemble of oscillators with this Hamiltonian, right? Each oscillator has their own little harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian, and it's just at the sum of those. And so from this system, which quantum states, rho, can we extract work out of via Gaussian unitaries, and which can we not? So just a little bit of math. I don't like going into technical details in my talks, but I try to do it enough here that hopefully those of you who are not familiar with Gaussian quantum mechanics will at least get a picture of what's going on. As I said before, if you have any state rho, you can associate on this kind of system, you can associate with it its covariance matrix, sigma, which just has this definition. We take it's a matrix of the second moments in phase space. This X is just a vector of your quadrature operators, and so you take products of those and you say, okay, what are the expectation values? How uncertain are we in the QQ direction of some oscillator? How uncertain are we in the Q1 P5 direction of, you know, the first and fifth oscillator or whatever? This contains all that information. If rho is a Gaussian state, this fully characterizes the state. I will mention you should also include the mean of your state in phase space, not just here we go. So just for the purposes of simplicity, I'm going to assume that we have, if this is our phase space, as you're either aware, I'm going to assume that we have some Gaussian state which has some Wigner function on this phase space that maybe looks like this or whatever. I'm going to assume we will always have a zero mean state here. This work includes when you have a coherent state, but just for simplicity purposes, I want to just focus on this. A couple of simple examples of covariance matrices are if we say we just have a single oscillator. If our covariance matrix is of this form, then on phase space, this looks just like a circle, right? This is sort of at the uncertainty in Q and the uncertainty in P. So we have this sort of Gaussian centered on the middle, which is rotationally invariant. And this turns out to be generally a thermal state. This is what a thermal state looks like within a phase space picture. Okay. You can also have other states, say this one. Say we apply some symplectic operation on this one to bring it to here. This would be a squeezed thermal state. We have increased the uncertainty in Q and decreased the uncertainty in P. And this would be an example of a symplectic operation, just as I say here. There's some matrix S, which if you go, you know, rho nu is equal to S times, sigma nu is equal to S times sigma times S transpose, you get a new covariance matrix corresponding to some new distribution in phase space. Right. So since our Hamiltonian, which I put up before, is quadratic, this means that the energy of our state depends only on these. The average energy of our state depends only on these entries of the covariance matrix and on the mean in general, like I put up there. Okay. Just as, this isn't super important, but just as a side note, this statement is true whether or not rho is Gaussian, okay? If rho is not Gaussian, it will have other moments in phase space, but you can still ask what is its covariance matrix, and the Hamiltonian and the average energy will still depend just on these entries and on its mean. Yeah, so this is just going back for a second. Right, so this is the definition of Gaussian passive, just as I've already said. Assuming we have the quadratic Hamiltonian, which here we do. The state rho is Gaussian passive if and only if, or if it is passive with respect to Gaussian unitaries. And as I said, this does not mean that we need to consider Gaussian rho. It just means that we're going to consider Gaussian operations. Going back here, quick other mathematical definition. Similar to before, if there exists a symplectic matrix S such that when you apply it on your covariance matrix, whatever your state is, it's quite easy to compute the energy given a covariance matrix. If that energy is less than it was before, then for some a symplectic matrix, then your state is not Gaussian passive. Okay. If you can't find a symplectic, then it is Gaussian passive. So after all this, I'm going quite fast. Actually, no, it's okay. What does a Gaussian passive state look like? This is going to be a little bit, okay, don't worry too much. I'm going to allow you to see the trees through the forest here, or is it forest through trees? I can't remember. This is what we proved in this paper, is the fact that a state rho is Gaussian passive, if and only if its covariance matrix is in what's called Williamson normal form. That is symplectically diagonalized. I'll talk about this in a second. With symplectic eigenvalues following an increasing order for decreasing frequencies of your modes. Remember, we have a collection of oscillators which may have different frequencies, right? If mode 2 has frequency greater than mode 1, if this is going to be Gaussian passive, we need the symplectic eigenvalue of the second one to be less than the first. Now, what is all this math? A Williamson normal form is just the analog of your density matrix being diagonalized. Okay, for any covariance matrix, there exists a symplectic such that you can bring your covariance matrix to some new one that is diagonal in this form. Okay, so it's just a collection. These are the blocks corresponding to each of your modes, and each of your modes has this diagonal form. It's proportional to unity. Okay, this is what I mean by this form. If you remember before, I showed you that little picture of the single mode covariance matrix, which was just new, and I mentioned that was a thermal state. So here we have a direct sum, or in the Hilbert space picture, a product state of thermal states. Okay, so a state which is Gaussian passive is a product of thermal states of each of your modes, such that these quantities nu, which they quantify the mixedness of your state. For thermal states, which these are, the nus are just given by this formula. If you have the particle content, the thermal particle content of some mode, then the corresponding eigenvalue is this. All this means is that I'm going to come back to this in one second. So all this means is that rho is Gaussian passive if at the level of the second moments, your state is a product state of thermal states for each of the modes, such that their particle content is decreasing with increasing frequency. Okay, just going to go back for 1 second. Because it's very good to quickly compare this condition for Gaussian passivity with the general condition for general passivity, right? Remember that for general passivity, if you have any unitary, a passive state is diagonal in the energy eigenbasis with decreasing population for increasing energies. So here we have a very analogous kind of scenario where it's almost the exact same within a phase space covariance matrix picture, but this was not obvious before. And what's kind of interesting is that there is so here this needs to be diagonal, here this needs to be diagonal, but diagonality in these two cases means very different things. Diagonality here means no coherence between your energy eigenstates. Here, diagonality means no correlations between your different modes. So those are two different things, but this turns out to be what the condition is for Gaussian passivity. So just an interesting comparison there. I'm almost done with this part. Just as a little example, if we have two modes, which have two different frequencies, omega 1 and omega 2, let's say they are both thermal at temperatures T1 and T2. As I said before, if we can do anything, if we can do any unitary, we're not restricted, then as long as you have two, then if you have a product state of two thermal states, as long as those temperatures are different, you can always get some work out. Okay? The same is not true for this. The same is not true when you are restricted to Gaussian operations. This statement is not obvious from what I've said, but from the theorem, it's not too hard to show that in this case, what it implies is that you can only get work out of these two thermal states at different temperatures if the temperatures and frequencies satisfy this kind of relation, where here omega 2 is assumed to be the larger of the two. So since omega 2 is larger, this is always restricted to be less than or equal to 1. So if these are the same, then you can't get work out as we know we should. But more generally, there's a more of a restriction. So this is just an example of, we knew that it would be more restricted when you're doing this, but this is just an interesting little example of how this is. And in fact, it's almost maximally restrictive in a certain sense. Just a final note on this project before I get to the somewhat more exciting one and the one that I don't have as much done yet. It can be shown, we show in this paper, that within a certain sense, the gap between the energy you can get out of a system using any unitaries or just using only Gaussian unitaries is in a sense maximal. An example of what I mean by this is you can show that if you have a covariance matrix, which is in this form, is Gaussian passive, there is always, so let's say you're given just some covariance matrix and it is Gaussian passive. You can always find some pure state which has this covariance matrix, which means that, and with from a pure state, you can always, no pure state is passive. You can always apply some unitary to bring it to the ground state. Sorry, the ground state is the only passive unitary. So in this sense, even if you can't get anything out from Gaussian operations, you may be missing out on all the energy in a sense. Okay, and there is an extension to mixed states that you can also make from this. So there's more details on all how this works and all the proofs and stuff within this paper, but this was just our first attempt at trying to answer this question about how much more restricted are you within this kind of context when you are only applying Gaussian operations. Any questions on this? Yes.
You also get like an activation of Gaussian passive state by considering the dendro product of them. It's like before you consider the activation of passive states. By taking the dendro product, then you said only the completely passive ones.
Okay, actually, yes, thank you. I forgot to mention this. All Gaussian passive states are also completely Gaussian passive. That's another, which I totally forgot to mention that. Thank you. Yes, that is also a result which comes from this, is that there's no such thing as a Gaussian passive state, which is, so if you have a Gaussian passive state, it doesn't matter how many copies of it you have, you still can't get any energy out of it, which is not the case for general passive states. I have no idea if that was your question or not. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Is there a physical reason why you consider only unitaries instead of completely positive maps?
Yes.
It would clearly break all of the theorem.
Yes, and it does. I mean, the definition of passivity that people use within this community is with unitaries. If you have access to general CP maps, then you can, I think, always extract work. I'm not sure that there's ever a state which you can't get work out of. Now, seeing if that's true also for Gaussian CP maps would be very interesting. I haven't done that yet, but that would also be interesting to see. Does that answer your question?
Well, is there a physical reason not to consider them? Like, I agree that
it, no, there's not.
The answer is uninteresting, perhaps.
No, there's no reason. We just haven't done it yet. Okay. So that was that. Hey, halfway. Perfect. Okay. Now, let's look at this second question. This was kind of one of my main motivations when I went to ICFO to do quantum thermal. I wanted to see, quantum thermodynamics right now is a field which is very disparate. As I listed all those points don't necessarily have much to do with each other. They do, but, it's kind of everywhere, and trying to sort of, people are still trying to bring it all together, in a sense. But no one has really thought to look at how Gaussian quantum mechanics as a computational framework can help us understand these questions. So this is what I want to do here. Again, it's restrictive. You can't do everything. Like, for example, people often say that, I've heard people say that Gaussian quantum mechanics is useless when it comes to quantum thermal, but that's just because there are these examples of tripartite autonomous engines, which indeed require third order interactions. But that's just one example of something that you can be looking at within quantum thermal. So it's certainly not true, as I hope to show here, that looking at Gaussian quantum mechanics is useless within this context. And what I'll be looking at specifically is a heat engine, a quantum harmonic heat engine. This is work with Alejandro Pozas and Karen Havansian, I think. And this is very much work in progress. I will be showing some results at the end, but they are still quite preliminary. As I'll discuss, there's a lot that can be explored with this. And so figuring out exactly the important questions and how to look at them is a large task. But I will show some stuff at the end, which we've done so far. So, as I kind of said before, you can't get work out of a thermal bath. It is a passive state, a completely passive state, in fact. And so, this seems kind of a bummer. You have, because we have a thermal state everywhere. Almost everything in nature is in a thermal state. So it kind of sucks that we can't get energy out of it. But there's an easy solution, which people figured out during the Industrial Revolution, that if you have two thermal baths of different temperatures, you can get work out, as I've already said, assuming they are different temperatures. And this is kind of the basic idea behind all heat engines. The basic idea behind all heat engines is that you have some process, some what we call working body, that does something, that somehow interacts with these two baths in some way, which, even though you can't get useful energy out of a single bath, by doing something where you have heat being taken out of the hotter bath and then being put into the cooler bath, this quantity will be less than this, and the extra energy can be brought out as useful work, which you can then charge a battery or drive a car or whatever. And just a quick side note, this is also how fridges work. It's just at the time reverse, right? Here we are making this cooler, this hotter, and getting energy out. In a fridge, you put energy in, you have to plug it in. And you, if you ever put your hand behind a fridge, you'll notice it's quite warm. That's outputting heat by making this cooler. Okay, it's just at the time reversed of a heat engine. But that's not really important for this. What we're going to be specifically looking at here is what's called an auto engine, a quantum auto engine in this case. We can take a qubit, as is often done, but here we'll use an oscillator for our purposes, as our working body, as well as we will make our baths consist of oscillators, okay, at temperatures. Excuse me. So the basic working behind an auto engine is that, say, we have some oscillator up here of a frequency omega 1. We couple it to our hot bath in some way. It thermalizes, hopefully, such that here it's hot. And what we do then is, with this hot oscillator, we adiabatically lower its gap without changing its population. Its state remains in a thermal state just with a lower frequency. And by this means, we get outwork. Okay, because that is lowering the energy of your state. If you have the same state of your oscillator, but you just decrease the gap, that gives you energy. That it decreases the energy of your state. So we decrease adiabatically to some other frequency, omega 2. The next step is that we couple it to some cool bath. So this will dump heat into our cool bath, cool down our oscillator here. We then want to increase again adiabatically the frequency. This will take work. This will require work to put in. But because the thermal population of the state down here is less than up here, right here it's hot, here it's cold, this will take less work to increase the gap than work we get out here. So we put in some work, but afterwards we get out more. And so this is the way the auto engine works. So we get a net overall output. Right, just for terminology purposes, I'm going to call these strokes a thermalization stroke, a stroke because within an engine you have a cylinder which does strokes. And I'm going to call these strokes the adiabatic strokes. Adiabatic because we do them slowly enough such that the state does not change over the course of the strokes. The gap changes, but the state with respect to your Hamiltonian does not change, if that makes sense. Does that make sense? Okay. So, I mean, this has been kind of, this model has been around for a while, and it works great if you assume ideal scenarios, right? That is, if you assume that, you know, here I've just kind of said, okay, we have some large bath, so here we end up with a thermal state of temperature at T1. That's not necessarily how it will work in practice, right? We assume infinite baths. We assume long thermalization times, long enough to properly thermalize. We assume that when you couple to the bath, you do so smoothly enough that there's not any quench effects that will degrade your system. All these things. So what I wanted to do with these tools of Gaussian quantum mechanics is to look at this model, but less ideally. Okay, I wanted to see what the limitations are of this in like an actual fully quantum scenario. And paradoxically enough, that requires using Gaussian to help solve the dynamics. Again, we'll take both baths to consist of oscillators as well as our working body. Our working body will just be a single oscillator, and our baths will be some number of oscillators. And the questions that we want to ask here are kind of the following. How are the efficiency of your engine? How are the lifetime? How many cycles it can run for before it becomes useless? How much energy can you get out before it becomes useless? How are all these affected by certain things? How are these affected? For example, I mean, the obvious first question is, how does this change with the size of your bath? If you have an infinite bath, then you can imagine that if you have, you know, say you have an infinite collection of oscillators and you couple your working body to some of them over here, and then you do your thermalization, that will affect your thermal bath, but those effects will propagate away, and since it's infinite, they'll just never come back, and it's fine. And you can just keep working your engine over and over and over again. If you have a finite bath, though, that's going to break down at some point. So, for example, how does it work with how many oscillators n we have in our bath? Also, how does it change when you have different structures for bath? Well, the results that I'll be showing use a ring of a number n oscillators, but we could also consider doing much more complicated structures. But what we found is that it's hard to get good results when you have sort of a more densely packed bath. That tends to ruin things, actually, which was a little bit of a surprise. Again, we need to do a lot more exploration, so all that I'm saying is take it with a small grain of salt. This is one question that we wanted to ask. Another one that's obvious to ask is how does your performance, how is it affected by what kind of interaction you do here between your working body and your bath? And which bath oscillators do you connect with, and how many, right? What we'll end up doing is we'll just connect to one here, but we've also explored how it's affected by doing a multiple or connecting to opposite ends, et cetera. You can look at all these things. And the time scales of your interaction. So in general, so what we do here is we say that our interaction Hamiltonian during a single thermalization stroke is going to be just some switching function with some strength, with just the Q of our working body tensored with the Qs of however many oscillators we choose to couple to. As I said, with the result I'll show, it's just a single one, but in general, it could be multiple. You can also consider a Qs and Ps or Ps and Ps or whatever. And the other thing is that the switching function we take to be some smooth switching on and then thermalized for some time, switching off. This, it turns out that it's not hard to, this doesn't end up being too detrimental, but in general, having these switchings will cause their quenches, right? So they will cause quanta creation, which will generally degrade the performance of your engine. We found that you can have these being quite short compared to the thermalization times without really affecting your bath or your engine too badly. But if it's sharply switching, then it quite strongly affects it. So you have to do it smoothly. Last question, which I will not be answering really, as we haven't done it yet, is how do all these things go hand in hand with the buildup of correlations within your system? And this is one of the most interesting questions, which unfortunately we have not had time to fully explore yet, aside from the fact that there are correlations, as you would expect. So, for example, if we start off, we have a brand new engine with perfect heat baths and some working body that we have in a given state, and we have set them up such that there's no correlations between the baths and the working body. After a single stroke, or after a single thermalization stroke with the hot bath, there will generally be a correlations built up between the bath and the working body. So, I mean, that's not to be, that is to be expected. And then, at the next one, you'll have correlations built up here. And then you will also have, in general, correlations built up at second order between your two baths. I wasn't sure how to properly draw it. And so, how do all these, as well as tripartite correlations as well, up between all three systems. So again, you have to wait for another day to find out, aside from the fact that all these correlations do build up, they are there, but how the correlations correlate with all these questions I've been asking, I can't yet say, but that's one of the things that we want to ask. So let's recall what we're doing again. This is our basic cycle, just for purposes of explaining exactly how we do things. We do assume that the adiabatic strokes are ideal in the sense that when we do the stroke, we don't do anything aside from just saying, okay, how much work do we put in? Do we put in, and we specify what the change in frequency is. We assume I mean by ideal is that we assume that the state here is the same as the state here, okay, which is the usual assumption. And similarly between here and here. But the more interesting part, and why we're doing this, is to see how the dynamics of these thermalization strokes work out. This is where all the messiness will come in, right? So quick mathematical interlude as to how we actually do this. Assuming we have a quadratic Hamiltonian, which we are using for both our free and our interaction Hamiltonian, right? This will ensure that our dynamics are Gaussian, meaning that we go from Gaussian states to Gaussian states. Okay. the way this works is if our Hamiltonian is quadratic, we can always put it in this form, where this is just the vector of quadratures, and F is some matrix on phase space, which is the Hamiltonian of representation on phase space, basically. And within this framework, you have that, as I've already said, a unitary transformation on your state row will correspond to a symplectic transformation on your covariance matrix in phase space, where we solve for this asymplectic evolution via a matrix, a differential equation, which is basically the Schrodinger equation, just sort of in a phase space picture. Okay, this is just the symplectic form, don't worry about that, but basically it's just time derivative of S is equal to phase space version of Hamiltonian times S, similar to what we have here. Okay, the key difference as to why this is easier is because these are 2n by 2n matrices, whereas these are n by infinity times n by infinity matrices. These are operators, and these are matrices. Okay, so that's why, in general, things are easier to do with Gaussian quantum mechanics. So this is what we do. We solve the evolution of a symplectic matrix, or of the symplectic evolution during the thermalization strokes, and then we just see how the cycle goes. Right, just to give another quick little idea of how this works. Again, let's imagine that we've already been running our cycle for a bit. So we have, and then we want to do a cold bath stroke. So we connect our working body with our cold bath. These are already in some states. This is probably already degraded by some amount. This is in whatever state it is. And we generally have correlations between these two already, right? We switch on with this function, we solve the evolution, and what we do is we take whatever state, equivariance matrix, we have for this subsystem before the stroke, which is generally comprised of, you know, this is the system part, this is the bath part, the cold bath part. The nice thing about Gaussian quantum mechanics as well is that, like I said, it's a direct sum structure. So if I wanted to, for example, just look at the reduced state of the bath or the reduced state of just the working body, I don't have to do a partial trace. I just take this. I just take that block. So it's quite simple in that way. And these off-diagonal terms represent the give the correlations. So we solve for the symplectic evolution via that equation on the previous slide. We come up with some new state, which is a direct sum, and then we keep going, and we see, you know, how this has evolved, how the bath has evolved, etc. So that's good. That's the idea. Let's look at some plots. This is basically the end. I just wanted to now show some of the preliminary results that we have. So let's just look at one of these cycles. This is just to show you that things do kind of work. Here we have, we initialize, this is the temperature as a function of time of our working body as we evolve it over a thermalization stroke. Here we start it in a thermal state of temperature 1. Our bath is in a thermal state of temperature 4. We evolve, works nicely. Okay, we see that it thermalizes quite well. This is not always the case, by the way. Depending on your parameters or the bath or other stuff, this can not be so nice looking, but it's easy to get thermalization if you want to. So that's good that happens. Great. Now let's look at what actually happens with the cycle and how we get that work. This plot is one where we have our two baths, each having 200 modes. And on this axis is the sort of the number of the adiabatic stroke. So one here is we do the stroke that we get energy out of, two is the stroke that we have to put energy into, etc. So this number is kind of the number of cycles that we have times two that we have gone through, okay? Because each cycle has two adiabatic strokes. And this is the work output during each of those adiabatic strokes. So what we see is kind of interesting. We have, okay, we get work out. The first one, as expected. Next one, on the input stroke, we have to put in work, right? But we have to put in less than we have gotten out. So this makes sense that this is what we expect. And then boom, something changes. We still get slightly more work out than we have to put in, but this is an obvious shift. And what this is you may have guessed, is this is when the quanta from the first interaction have now wrapped around the ring and are starting to affect the engine. Okay, this is the degradation of the bath that we are seeing. Right, so we have some chain of oscillators. We've connected our working system. This is in a thermal state. We do our first interaction cycle. This, you know, locally changes the state here, but then this change propagates across the ring such that as they propagate, they kind of leave a nice thermal looking state here again, right? So then on the next stroke, we get a similar output. But then after a while, as you might expect, this catches up with you and you start looking and you start seeing that your bath is degrading. So that's for 200 modes, that's for 300 modes. As you expect, it lasts longer, but again, at some point you start not doing so well. If you continue this, I couldn't get the resolution on this very good, but this is if you continue for a lot of strokes and you kind of see the same structure here, but then by the time you've reached 300, or I guess 150 cycles, your bath or your engine is useless, basically. So that's not too good news, but it is what it is. Just to show this what we actually get out of this, what I'm going to show next is the total work output, i.e., the total amount of work that we've gotten. That is the integral of this, basically, as a function of cycle number. And what we find is this, that as I kind of said, you go up, but then at a certain point, like 150 or 200, even by that point, your engine is useless, or your baths are useless, rather. Okay. At this point, you kind of just fluctuate and don't get much. This is for 300 modes, just to show the difference between 300 modes and less modes. If you consider a very small bath, this is for 30 modes. That should be a 30. In this case, it just, of course, you don't last very long. You don't get much, and it's much more sporadic what you get out, which is kind of interesting. So I know that wasn't much results. It was just a very basics of what we've done so far. We would like to explore this more for, all the parameters that we can. But just to sort of recap briefly, because I think I'm done, is these were the two questions that we wanted to ask, and I hope that I have at least partially, slightly answered them for you a little bit. And I hope, this stuff, I find it interesting, and I hope that I managed to at least share that with you a little bit. And please do stay tuned for the further results on the auto engine, because I'm hoping that those will be kind of cool. Thank you again for the invitation to Lucian and Rob, and all of you for listening. And let's do some questions. If there are any, yep.
So it's a closed system in unitary dynamics, right?
Correct.
So if you ram this for long enough, should you get some kind of periodic structure where suddenly all the energy is dumped back and you have a heat bath recovery?
That's a very good question. I mean, you can, but it requires fine tuning. That's the thing, because the timing between how long you set a given thermalization stroke and the timing of how fast things propagate in your chain and with how large your chain is, these all have to line up in order to get this kind of effect you're talking about, right? In general, you just get this messiness if you don't fine tune. But I mean, in general, I mean, what you're talking about, if you do fine tune it, what you'll find is that, you will, okay, I haven't done this, so I shouldn't say, but what I suspect is that you will get up to a certain amount, it'll do this, and then it will sort of decrease very rapidly, and then do this, and then go up again, and do this. So that still will not end up giving you more total work output at the end, right? Because, I mean, we know that the work output has to be limited, because if you have a finite systems, two finite baths, the free energy is finite. So you have to have some limit, right? So. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the idea of running this in reverse as a refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
How would you expect the refrigerator to behave as we ran it for longer periods of time?
That's a good question.
Would it become more or less efficient as time goes on, perhaps? Or
I would assume so. Oh, actually, that's a good question. I'm not sure. Because, that's a very good question. Because that doesn't have the same limitation. I mean, here we have, as I just said, we have a finite free energy that we can get out. There's no reason why you can't just, as far as I can see, put more work in to get a greater temperature difference. So actually, that's a very good question. I should look at that. Thanks. At least as far as I can see right now. I haven't thought of that before. Comments? Criticisms? Yeah?
This paper by Pescu and Paul Skripchak and Tony Short, a few others on quantum thermal machines from a few years back, and it talks about how there are to understand heat engines in terms of virtual qubits.
Yes, I know which one you're talking about, yeah.
Given the strong analogy between qubit systems and harmonic oscillator systems, I would imagine that maybe in the Gaussian regime there was a similar analysis that was possible.
It's possible. I mean, I know which paper you're talking about, but I can't remember the details well enough to be able to say really if that would be possible or not. It was a different framework for understanding these processes within sort of a virtual excitation framework.
Basically, like there's some virtual qubit whose population.
Yes.
When you look at the composition that you have, that's where you're getting the energy from.
Yeah. So if we were to, if the same idea were to go through with oscillators,
there'd be some virtual oscillator.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like in terms of your original oscillator, mm-hmm. two paths, and that virtual oscillator would be population inverted, and you understand the
mm-hmm.
extraction in terms of.
And if you restrict that to a Gaussian framework, I wonder how that would.
Well, it's kind of closer to what you were saying earlier about these passive states that are not completely passive, right? There's
mm-hmm.
some population inversion somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But now you kind of have a concrete model, and you could, in the Gaussian regime, it might be a little bit easier to see exactly where that population inversion is.
But also within a Gaussian, at least what I said within the Gaussian passivity context, is that there are no completely Gaussian passive states. So I'm not sure how it would work.
Well, this analysis at the end of the heat engine, you weren't. I'm not sure what the relevance of passivity stuff is, but.
I mean, I'm not sure that there is any direct relevance between the two projects. Maybe I mean, what we have in the second one is we have two different. Interesting.
Let me put it this way, then. There seems to be a tension here, but if you thought that the qubit analysis in that paper on quantum thermal machines would go through and you would be able to understand the action
yeah.
of heat engine in terms of population inversion in some virtual oscillator,
mm-hmm.
and that seems to be in tension with your result about how there are no Gaussian passive states except the completely passive ones, because that would seem to suggest that I can't find a virtual oscillator whose population is perfect.
That would be.
So there's some tension to be resolved there. Right?
Yes, I agree. That would be good to look at. Thank you.
Eric, in your simulation of your heat engine, you do the thermalizing stroke, and then the adiabatic stroke. It would take some time for that to happen.
Correct.
A long time. And so, in your simulations, do you have the heat baths like have free evolution among themselves while? You're doing that adiabatic stuff?
Good question. Not during the adiabatic, because we don't specify a time for the adiabatic.
Yeah.
I mean, this goes back to his question where, there would be certain sets of timings which would give you some sort of resonance effect,
nice.
Which we have not looked at that for the adiabatic strokes because that's not how we model them. In the future, maybe we should. We do consider the free evolution of, say, the cold bath while we interact with the hot bath, but not during.
Okay, I see.
But not during
the
adiabatic cycles.
The adiabatic steps are assumed to be short. They've taken the view of no length.
Exactly. Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rockliffe's time to speak.
Thanks.